Hello, Dan.
Hello, Joe.
How are you?
All right.
All right.
Yeah, I'm mostly recovered from being sick, but I'm probably going to mute and cough a few times.
That's fine.
Yeah,
You know,
yeah.
I'm
How are
sure
you?
audience would appreciate it. Audio quality is of paramount importance to us.
It's the most important thing about this show that we do here.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm fine. I'm doing all right. I got home a little earlier than expected. Beat the rain. All
Oh, it's raining.
well, there was like maybe 30 to 40 minutes of light drizzle that probably threw Los Angeles into chaos. But I made it home before that, so it was
That's
fine.
nice, though. A little drizzle, cool off your day.
The plants need it. It's what plants crave.
Yeah, it is, actually.
But it's fine that it rained and that I got home and that my life is the way that it is. There's not really much more to say about that subject.
It's fine that my life is the way that it is. Could be better, could be worse, that kind of stuff.
But after you've recovered and you experienced the town of Jerome,
Well, I
we
mostly experienced the hotel room in a city called Jerome.
you see, you had a great time.
I had a great time. It was like 30 degrees. I think I had a Reuben and a chicken sandwich and a breakfast sandwich.
How was the Reuben?
Thankfully, they were liberal with the sauce, so there was some flavor.
So the pastrami itself,
Yeah,
or
no. I
corned
mean,
beef, did not have much flavor.
it had the texture of corned beef, but it had the flavor of nothing. I was going to say grocery store deli meat, but it didn't even have that much flavor.
That's
The
sad.
people were lovely, though.
Yeah, well, that's what they say. You go to Jerome for the people.
Is that what they say? I think they say you go for the dead people, the ghosts, because it's a haunted town.
Well, it's okay. They're just all the ghosts of copper miners that died.
Inhaled too much copper.
Or, from alcoholism or prostitution or any of the other things that were going on at the town at the time. It's an interesting place. I was reading about it when you told me that you were going.
Were you really? Did you find anything good?
No, just those things that I said.
Just that there was prostitution and copper mines and people died and stuff.
Yeah, and there was like 70% men or something in like the late 1800s because it was just so heavy on the mining.
Yeah. It's a very remote little town. It's just on the backside of a mountain, up high, kinda.
Did you try any of the wine from the tool guy?
I did not. The lady had a sampling, and she came home with a bottle of white.
Of what kind?
I don't know. I didn't look at it. The white one.
Really left an impression.
Yeah.
We talked about a remote town last time. We talked about Perfection, Nevada, a fictional place, and we talked about this dusty old place where things weren't going well for people, and that's why we're going into Tremors 2 this week, where we return to the scene of the crime and
That's why I personally went to Jerome over the weekend,
to
is
do
to get
research on small towns.
to get into the mindset, really, to really understand the motivation behind these salt of the earth people.
Yeah, no. Actually, audience, Dan has been very insistent that we either do something current and good or something at least, current and newsworthy, I guess, Oscar-worthy.
I voted for current and new, but I would take one of those two things. And I think current and new, current and good. But I think we kind of got both this time. Or at least we, according to critical reception, we got both. Your mileage may vary. You being Joe, so we'll see.
But Dan picked Dolomite Is My Name, the Eddie Murphy vehicle. It is a biopic of Rudy Ray Moore's life, and his efforts in getting his movie Dolomite made by Hook or by Crook. It makes for an exciting comeback for Eddie Murphy, who has been absent from things for some time. Unfortunately, for all parties involved, this is a Netflix movie, and it mostly flew under, I think, literally everyone's radar, except you may have seen word of it pass by you and realize that it had maybe come out at some point, and you did not know when or under what circumstances, and the answer was Netflix.
a lot of word of mouth talking about it being a good movie. I have no idea when it actually came out, and I don't know. I don't think I heard about it in any fashion other than the occasional Dolomite is My Name is a good movie tweet on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your reception of it as well?
Yeah. And of course, Eddie Murphy returned to Saturday Night Live to host for the first time.
That's right. That makes sense.
Was it 30, 35 years?
I meant to watch that. I didn't get around to it.
Yeah, I saw bits and pieces. I ended up going to sleep. But
you're not a big Eddie Murphy fan.
I mean, I like Eddie Murphy. I am selective about certain Eddie Murphy performances, I suppose. Some stuff, it's just like, okay. You know.
Not a big Norbit fan?
No, not a huge Norbit fan. It's... That was, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s. I think he tapered off well before the mid-2000s. We had, you know,
when
kind
was
of...
Pluto Nash? That's the question.
Yeah, that was... It's just like a mixed bag of things going on.
Meet Dave made it all the way to 2008.
Oh, man. I think that might be the last thing I can think of that he was
Tower
doing.
Heist, 2011.
When was the last Shrek that he contributed his voice to?
Shrek's Yule Log was a short in 2010. Shrek's Thrilling Tales is a video short in 2012. But the last full Shrek... Oh, Shrek the Halls, also a short. Shrek the Third, 2007. Oh, Shrek Forever After, sorry.
Yeah.
2010.
Okay. So he's smaller.
He's been Shrekking it up.
Yeah, but he was doing smaller things, basically, for about the past 15-ish years, let's say.
The Haunted Mansion.
Oh, that was bad. You see, Disney decided to turn their rides into movies, and they had huge success with Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, and they said, hey, The Haunted Mansion. And they tried to do the same sort of thing where they're like, Johnny Depp plus ride, and so they were like, Eddie Murphy plus ride. And it didn't pan out into a franchised series of pictures as The Curse of the Black Pearl did, into a bunch of other Pirates of the Caribbean movies. So that's, you know, unfortunate, I guess. But Eddie Murphy has had a pretty historic run in cinema and everything else, basically. He's a very common name in comedy and acting, I feel like, despite the fact that he hasn't been super active recently. Mm-hmm. So
he achieved. He's one of those guys, like on the level of like Steve Martin, who accomplished basically everything there was to do in comedy, and then just said like, "Well, I give up." / whatever.
You know, unfortunately, Eddie Murphy hasn't started a banjo band, so it's a little bit. Maybe some other hobbies that we don't know about, but
he's
feel
coming
like,
back to America and or Beverly Hills, so he's doing some stuff again.
Yeah. And the director of Dolomite Is My Name is going to be the director of Coming Back to America 2.
Coming to America. America. Sorry, I said a stupid version of the name, but yeah.
Craig something last name Craig thing. It has escaped my brain. I think he has said himself that he got busy with like personal life stuff and like taking care of his kids and things. And
oh yeah, he's got 10 kids.
That's a lot of kids. So he, you know, was busy, despite the fact that he wasn't, you know, publicly busy. But it's a sort of return to form for him, and he had apparently been trying to get this movie made since 2003. And the life of Mr. Moore had seemed interesting to Eddie Murphy for this whole run up. They had a script, basically. The two guys who worked on the script for this had started in 2003, and then it just kind of got shelved and sat there until a few years ago.
Until the likes of Netflix came around with large budgets for movies?
Yeah, and, you know, not giving a lot of studio notes, let's say. Which has its...
Does this movie feel like it is absent of notes to you?
I don't know, necessarily. It's hard to tell strictly speaking, the absence of notes. You can kind of guess at it when things sort of ramble and go in weird places. But
that's usually on more like a Will Ferrell-style movie where there's just ad-libbing upon ad-libbing, and they're just like, why aren't they cutting it?
Yeah, or you got your things where they're like, oh, well, we can't release this commercially, like Cloverfield Paradox. We'll just dump it on Netflix. In this particular case, you know, Netflix has been handing out bushels of money to get things made. They haven't had the same concerted effort behind the marketing of their films, unfortunately, which, again, I think is why Dolomite Is My Name came and went without nary a tweet about it.
I guess we can't even say came and went, because it just came and it's there. Like, it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's true, because it's Netflix, and their whole thing is, like, day and date online.
Watch it forever until you die.
Yeah, but they give some of their other filmmakers theatrical windows for their pictures.
Oh, did this one not get a theatrical run for award season stuff?
Not that I am aware of. I don't think any lobbying was conducted on the part of Eddie Murphy, on behalf of Eddie Murphy, I should say. Eddie Murphy may have lobbied, but I don't think Netflix did anything about it.
Because it is nominated for a lot of awards, which I very briefly scrolled through. But yeah, I don't know that it made it in for... Oh, it was nominated for a Golden Globe. Well, that doesn't mean it was...
No, that's the Hollywood Foreign Press. It's like you could put every movie into a bag and shake it, and then you're going to get something out of that. But, you know, Dolomite Is My Name is, I think, a good movie. It's an appealing movie.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I'm kind of been puzzling over it for the same reason that when we were talking about, like, awards worthiness, which has affected the conversations that a lot of people have been having about cinema recently, because... there's a lot of hubbub about your you know, perennial annual Oscars so white situation, because very white. But also you have this situation where you're like, well, would Dolomite have been an Oscar worthy contender? And then you look at some of the other nominees and you're like, well, maybe would I like this more than that other one? And you think about it that way for a little bit. And I don't know. I don't know where I sit on that in terms of awards worthiness, but I'm not a, you know, Academy Award voting person.
It is kind of an anti-Academy Award movie. Like, I mean, one of the main themes in this is, like, screw the system, screw the critics. They don't know what people actually enjoy watching, and we're just going to do it ourselves and get it out to the people, which is, you know, almost... like talking directly to Netflix and the audience and saying, screw you, Academy, people are going to enjoy this whether you approve of it or not. So there is a little bit of that, you know, to contend with. I mean, that's the story and what they're doing at the same time.
Oh yeah, absolutely, for sure. And how should I put this? The way Eddie Murphy portrays Moore is, as a man who can understand sort of this sort of base of, like, lowest common denominator appeal of certain things, but there's no shame in it or cynicism. So it's not that it's craven like Bob Odenkirk's executive guy is.
Yeah, he understands that he has skill and talent, and he uses that to sort of craft a comedy act that he knows will resonate with people because it's already resonating with people. He's just making a more polished, better performed version of it. He's basically saying, like, people enjoy this. I'm going to perform this thing, which is, it's not like saying, you know, I'm not making The Godfather. I'm making a spectacle that people are going to enjoy and have fun with. But he seems very... there's that line that he says to Lady Reed in the bar when he first sees her, that some people walk around with their own personal spotlight or whatever it was, and they're just born to be stars. And he clearly very much thinks of himself as, like, he's already a star. He just needs to have the act that the people will enjoy watching him do. He's an actor looking for a resurgence in several ways. And he's finding his vessel in this Dolemite character in the comedy and the movie itself. So he's just like, he's committed to this sort of like very high concept pitch from the very beginning and just going at it full bore and, you know, squeezing every ounce of blood from the stone that he can get and saying like, this, I'm taking this all the way, taking it all the way to the Supreme Court and then putting it in a movie theater.
Yeah. But another thing that's interesting about it is he wants that adulation, but it's not, he doesn't seem to have a preciousness vanity about certain things. Like for instance, he's willing, when he has a confrontation with Wesley Snipes' character at one point in the film where he's like, you know, you're not above any of this. I'm putting all this on the line. I'll go down there and make sandwiches if I have to. But like, so it's like he wants to be loved and have that attention and to be a part of it and for people to see his ability, to entertain, but he's not above doing the work to get that entertainment. Whereas you contrast that with Wesley Snipes' character, who is above doing the work.
Yeah, he's got ego, but he's willing to work hard to show off. I guess that's the difference between ego and a show off. Like, he wants to show off, whereas Wesley Snipes is just trying to ride by on his ego and his name and drink vodka orange juice out of a Gatorade container next to a camera. But I think the interesting part of this movie to watch, just in terms like from the perspective of like, here's the artist doing his thing, is anytime he attempts to play anyone else's game, he gets depressed and starts to lose until he figures out a way to do things on his own terms, which is of course like the entire point of this character, to just like, you know, bootstrap it yourself and then the people will love you. Like, you don't have to play by other people's rules because systems and blah blah blah. But that's his personal struggle, and that's what you would expect anyone to go through, is to say like, well, I don't know how to make a movie. Like, these are the structures and the struggles that you have to go through to make a movie. And so you realize like, well, not really. I mean, I need a kid with a camera and then all my friends who are good at stuff, but like, we're just going to go do stuff that we enjoy doing. Like, after Wesley Snipes kind of like poops on everyone's parade and says like the movie's over and like walks out, they're all sort of sad in the room there, but it's like, no, man, we made a movie together. Like, we did costumes and music and stuff. Like, they were having fun. Like, that's what it was all about. And like, you know, trying to bring that energy to a larger group of people is like the fun part of this to watch, which is like obviously Rudy's character arc here and his story.
Yeah. And I would say, unfortunately, at times the specific writing around the low point, figuring it out, high point, I've conquered my problem stuff, can feel a little formulaic in the movie.
You sure can, because this movie is definitely standing on the shoulders of things like Ed Wood and, for me, a little bit of like Blues Brothers with the whole like bootstrapping stuff. Obviously, they're not doing it to save a orphanage or whatever, but it's slightly more egocentric. But a lot of that same sort of stuff is built into this general storyline.
Yeah, well, and this is also, I think, a scooch more down to earth than Blues Brothers. It's interesting in that the movie that they're making, which is a real movie.
That's the other thing about this. Like, so much of this is real, like real.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know all the specific. It's not like somebody's walking around with like a tape recorder, like recording the dialogue that happened between these characters. But
even watching the trailer for the actual Dolomite movie that we put in the Slack there or whatever, it's like, yeah, that looks exactly like what happened in this movie. Very realistic.
Well, it looked like what they were trying to film happening in this movie. This movie itself is pretty grounded. So it doesn't quite swing as wide and as far as the actual like material that they're referencing when they're actually making the film, which is interesting too. But you know, just a brief summary of this, like it starts with Eddie Murphy trying to convince Snoop Dogg to play something for him at the record store, where they apparently run a radio station at the back of the record store, and it's not going well. And he tries to talk about his act and stuff. And we have Tony, who's Titus Burgess, who's here as
love Titus.
Yeah, he doesn't get to do as much in this movie as I was kind of hoping for.
He's not Timmy Schmitting it up in here for sure, or Kimmy. Jesus, Timmy. What did I just... I'm very tired.
I would say that he mainly just has like a couple little like. There's some jokes at his expense, here and there, but you know, he plays it with as a person with a heart who's really trying at several points, but there's just not much dialogue for him. There is, of course, the vagrant who comes in off the streets, who Moore doesn't want to deal with, like getting rid of out of the record store, but has to actually confront about this. And this is where the vagrant starts describing all kinds of stuff with this sort of like rhyming joke format that he picks up on and he finds entertaining. But just notices. And then when Moore goes to his usual, like opening bit for like some sort of nightclub where, they have like one of those old lounges with like people sitting there having cigarettes and drinks and like some food,
is the comedian that, introduces the band, which was a thing at a time.
Yeah. The warm-up guy or whatever. And so he's doing that and he runs over his time and he gets berated by his boss and to stick to what he's supposed to be doing. And Moore's like, my name's not up on the thing. And he's like, well, yeah, this isn't, you know, you're not famous for anything. This isn't vaudeville. Just do what you do. And so he's down in the dumps about that. And it occurs to him to go back to that vagrant that he had come across to find him and to ply him with a little money and some booze for stuff that he can record so that he can sort of dissect what makes that work and what makes that appealing and then apply that to his own act. And he invents this character of Dolomite using his old like random collection of things from his performing days that have come and gone at this point in the film, as well as a wig. And this surprises the nightclub guy the next time he goes in, and the nightclub guy is like, just stick to your thing, and he doesn't stick to his thing, and so he goes up
there. Turns out it's a hit.
Yeah, wows the crowd. I would say this scene unfortunately falls victim to the same thing that happens with all stand-up depicted on film and television, where the audience reaction seems completely disconnected from the joke delivery that is occurring. So I don't know. It's not as entertaining as the audience seems to find it to be.
Well, maybe you just, need to be in that room and feel that energy and time and place and stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm saying like as depicted for film, it has, this is not the first time this has ever happened in cinema. Happens a lot, but this wows everybody, and so Moore realizes he's got a hit on his hands, and he gets the idea to do a comedy record instead of a music record that he had done before, which had flopped. And so he goes to his aunt to get some money for that, and the aunt is like, yeah, no. And then he's like, do it. And then even threatens her with a butter knife.
I like it, that part.
In a joking way. Yeah. And so she agrees, and he makes his record, but the record company... Well, he records his masters, I should say, and then because they do an impromptu thing, like in his apartment as a lounge.
A party record, a quote unquote party record, but like in his apartment because they don't have the time or the energy or the money to go find a place, and they're just going to do it themselves. And this again starts this whole like process of him doing something on his own, bootstrapping his own project, and then showing it to the world, and the world going, what the hell is this? You can't do this. And he'll saying, like, fine, I'll do it on my own, and I'll start pressing the records and selling them to people and making my own little covers and putting my little devil stamp on them because it's not suitable for children, and selling them at the record store where he works conveniently. So just like using every scrap of his network and his ability to sell the records. And then, you know, that becomes bigger. And then the record company comes calling saying, like, this, like, everybody loves your record. Like, all right, fine, we'll put it out. Even though it is absolutely filthy and we don't know what to do with this, we'll make some more and we'll sell some more. And they do. And he continues to tour and do that sort of thing.
Yeah. And through this touring, he meets Lady Reed, who knocks out, well, not knocks out, but
slaps the bejesus out of her cheating boyfriend. Or
she decks him. He slaps her first.
I thought she knocked him down with a slap too, but yeah, regardless. No.
Yeah, she balled up her hand into a fist and punched him in the face. And then the person that he was having an affair with escorts him out of the property. And then afterwards, after the show, Eddie Murphy as Moore goes over to her and buys her a drink, and she's like, don't even bother hitting on me, I'm in a really bad mood. He's like, you know what you were saying before, the spotlight on you, I can tell you're a star. And she's like, oh, I used to be a backup singer in New Orleans, but you know, those days are long behind me, I've got to support my son. And he's like, no, you're hilarious, I need you to do this, like, and she's like, I can't, like, look at me, I'm nothing. And he's like, you feel this hair, this is a wig, like, this is all just like a costume, you put it on like a superhero, and you can transform into this character who doesn't have these problems. And so she sees the appeal of that, and she
a nice little nod to the deeply broken individuals that go into show business in the first place, because they can hide behind a character and distract an audience from their own personal woes.
Yeah, and conjured up the discussion that Gene Smart has with Regina King in Watchmen, when she's like, yeah, everybody who does this is like deeply broken. It's like, yeah, that's true. Like,
in their own special way.
Yeah. So they put out an album together. She, you know, starts to make something for herself. So she moves out to Los Angeles area. He is touring and he's making money. And then he meets up with his friends, and they all decide to go see a movie. And Eddie Murphy's character, Moore, in an effort to try to like do something real fancy, decides that they're going to go see the really, you know, the big picture that's playing right now that everybody's talking about. And it turns out to be Front Page, starring Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon and Susan Sarandon. It was a Billy Wilder movie, which was a remake of a remake of a remake based on a stage play called The Front Page.
And people in the audience are definitely enjoying it, all except for Eddie Murphy and his friends, who are literally just like baffled and like, what the hell is this? And why are people like it? This is not enjoyable or fun in the slightest. Obviously, they are not the audience for this particular film, which of course gives Eddie Murphy, the serial entrepreneur in the film, the idea to say, we can make a movie. We can connect with a bunch of people. Like, we can put our own version of something up there that will connect with people like us. And that's how we become a real star. You got to get up there in that giant screen, and then everyone will see you. And then you'll be spread across the entire country/world instead of just touring from town to town doing performances.
Yeah, and that is pretty much the appeal for him, is like, instead of doing nightclubs all the time, he can just be a star, and everybody can see his performance, for themselves.
It's a pretty obvious evolution for anyone who's in show business slash wants to be a giant star because of their ego and share it with the entire world.
Yeah. Yeah, it pretty much is. His friends try to talk him out of it, like, how are you going to do that? Nobody's going to pay to see you. And he tries to approach various people to get them to sign on to making a movie, and they don't want to do it.
Surprise, surprise, they all say no. And he says, you know what he says? I'll do it myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Turns out, it totally does. Although he does get some help. You know, he goes back to his record company folk who have placed a bet on his incredibly filthy records and seen that that is a viable business opportunity. So again, using every resource at his disposal, he gets some cash from them and basically mortgages the royalties of all of his records in exchange for
the future, all future sales of his records, basically.
Sure. Basically saying, let me make my movie. You can have ownership of everything I've ever done slash will do, because I really want to make a movie because this is going to be my next big break. And they're like, you're insane. Fine, whatever, here, have some money. Even to the point that he has to come back later because they run out of film, which you probably shouldn't do when making a movie, because, you know, film is, yeah, is the thing you shoot it with.
I like the conversation that they had about how they even ran through the short ends.
Yeah, of course, because they're, you know, they're film students, and what film students do is they steal short ends, a film from people who didn't use it, and they just make their own movies with that.
Yeah, but before we get to that, he gets the money and he needs to set up a place to do this. And so he settles on the Dunbar Hotel, which we had seen earlier in the film, in an expository fashion about how it used to be.
In Junkie Alley.
Yeah, it used to be a big thing, but now it's just full of junkies.
It was really big back in the 20s.
But now they clear it out. Moore basically got it based on the agreement that he would be just sort of ground, was it like
caretaker.
So
he'll clear out of the junkies if you let me hang out, work slash live here and clean it up. He did a nice job cleaning it up too.
Yeah. I mean, there was some initial bumpiness, but he settles on this place and he starts to get these people involved. He's got Keegan Peele. Keegan Key of Key and Peele. Keegan is playing sort of a uptight, fussy
playwright.
Yeah, playwright. I don't know why I was using
really
all those extra words.
Eddie Murphy went to go see this really dramatic play, and he seemed really moved by it. And then he went and found Keegan after the show and said, like, hey, let's write a movie. And he's like, I don't understand your comedy. It's really offensive.
My favorite line of his is when he says, I can be humorous.
I can be humorous, yes.
That's so funny. But they, you know, they basically come to this agreement where he's going to get sort of his story and all the dramatic components from Keegan, and then he's going to add the comedy and the mass appeal to it. And they need a star. And so they approach, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name.
You Wesley Snipes character?
Wesley Snipes character, but
Derville
Martin.
Martin,
yes. So he approaches.
Don't forget how they approach him. They go to the strip club to find attractive women to be in the movie who are okay with nudity, and he happens to be there.
Yes. So they settle on talking to him about it, and he's like, oh, I've got an agent and an entertainment lawyer, and you need to go through them. You can't just come talk to me. And
he was an elevator operator in Rosemary's Baby.
Yes, it was.
I didn't look that up. Is that true?
It's true, and it's actually sadly it's very prominently displayed on his Wikipedia page. He had some roles, and this was one of the couple of times he directed something, he agreed to do it if he could be the director, which is a big deal. And it's a big deal for us, the audience, because that means we get to see Wesley Snipes just a mess in this movie, doing whatever that weird effete drunken, too good for this, staggering around deep V shirt thing is that he's doing the entire time. It is very entertaining to me.
It's like a it's like he's permanently at the Cannes Film Festival or something. I don't even know how to describe it. He's very Hollywood and very French at the same time.
It's fun though. But he's yeah, doing his thing. And so they're all at the Dunbar and they get the USC students who show up and they're like, are we at the right place?
This is an old abandoned hotel, not a soundstage. Although I don't know why film students show up saying like, where's the soundstage? Because if you're a film student, you're used to shooting in the worst locations.
I would have to assume that that line of dialogue was written to indicate that they had not been expecting these conditions, whether or not that is actually factually true. I don't know. But they start to, you know, deal with the practicalities of their situation, such as not having electricity, and they steal it from a next door building, which is actually a kind of fun scene of watching all the little lights come on inside the hotel, and they're just like, oh, there's a spark of life left in the old girl. We can get this going. And we have a conversation with Wesley Snipes' character where he pulls aside Eddie Murphy's character and complains about the DP being too young and he's not going to know how to light for, you know, black people versus white people for like absorbing light versus reflecting light. And he has this complicated conversation about how this isn't going to work. And he's just doubting that this is possible the entire time.
That did remind me of film school, by the way, because there was one person in one of my cinematography classes who kept insisting that there was a different way to shoot darker skin. And she's like, what about putting like gray gels over some of the lights or the lens or something? The cinematography teacher just kept going, no, what are you talking about? They're just people with a slightly different darker skin. You expose for the gray card like everything else and you just shoot it. Like, it's fine. What are you doing? Stop saying that.
So
people think there's some sort of trick to it. There's not. It's light. You just point the light at the stuff.
Well, but you need more light or to expose correctly.
A little bit. I mean, I suppose in the days of slower film, you need to make sure you get that right.
Well, it was a huge deal back in the days of film because what was it? Kodak didn't test at all for certain skin tones.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Obviously Fuji biased for more, Asian type skin tones, being from that they are from Asia, and, Kodak biased towards whiter skin tones.
Yeah. And
just in terms of color representation, it's not necessarily exposure, but like, yeah, you would look wrong.
Yes. Cause it was about what they would reproduce with the chemical components of the film, the celluloid.
Like, yeah, I think the part that amused me is the fact that, like, how far down the list of things that they should have been concerned about while making Dolomite, the color representation of the people being completely accurate is probably, like, way, way down.
Well, they didn't talk about the Kodak film stock that they had on hand.
Yeah.
I did
like seeing the lights. I was like, oh, that's a little Mole Richardson soft light. I liked one of those. There's little 200-watt guys. I used to have one of those a long time ago back at Intel. It was good. I like them.
Okay. Did you have one of those enormous cameras?
It's not really the camera is enormous. It's that it's a giant a case around the camera to keep the loud camera from infecting the sound. It's called a blimp.
It's huge.
Blimp.
It's a huge blimp. But they
it's a zeppelin.
Yeah, they set up to start doing the film, and they have people on, and they're filming the various scenes and. Some things are going better than other scenes. And, you know, they get an idea that some things are going better than other things on set.
The kung fu stuff is pretty great.
Yeah. And we eventually get to a point where they run out of money. And so he needs to go back to his record label, who he talks to on set, apparently. All of them. They all came down, and he gets them to agree to give him $10,000 more money. And they're like, you know, you're going to be indebted to us for like forever. Like, this is a big deal. Are you sure? Like, have you budgeted for contingencies for post? Have you done any of that? And so, you know, they're not played as like mustache twirling loan sharks in here, but they are very upfront about the fact that this is a business and they will, you know, get their money at the end of this process. So it's not about deceiving more, which is, I think, a good thing to make, because then it makes it more about Moore's determination as opposed to Moore being like plotted against, which right. I think would have read differently.
Yeah, every step of the way is basically people saying, are you sure you know what you're getting yourself into? Because this is a mess, and there's no way we see this going well for you, but if you want to do this, we'll help you in some way by, in this instance, giving them money. But they're like, all right, there's a cost to all this stuff, so better make sure you know what you're doing. And he just never stops betting on himself at any given point, and turns out that's the only way to succeed.
Yep. Life lesson. But
the oldest story in the book.
Bet on yourself. But they have a Wesley Snipes overhears this conversation, and so he goes up to Eddie Murphy afterwards, and he's like, yeah, so I overheard that whole thing. Use that in your performance for the Zen battle. And
he's got a little bit of renewed commitment, because he sees that this isn't just like a giant joke to everyone. He sees how committed Eddie Murphy is to actually making this movie, despite being incredibly misguided. So he says, fine, let's do this. Let's get into it. Let's be filmmakers and actors and talk about how we're going to use this and make it the best awful thing that we can make it.
Mm-hmm. And so they do. And they film their final scene, gunfight, ripping out
intestines out of him. I have to say, I'm a big fan of Wesley Snipes' outfit in that final scene too, because it's this like this printed like pajama style looking thing.
It's like,
with a belt tied around it, but also it's like open with no shirt underneath or something.
It's like part karate gi with like,
yeah, that's a good way to describe
with,
it.
Like two enormous black shirt pockets glued to the outside of it, so it's just,
but it's like a deep V, so it's a karate gi is really like a double-breasted jacket where it'll really cover you up if you wrap it, but this is like a single-breasted jacket where it's just like it's wide open down the center.
Yeah,
but karate gi is the great way to describe it.
Yeah, it's a very very interesting outfit. And then when he has the intestines ripped out and he's like, all right, cut, we're done, and he walks out of there.
Oh,
he walks out of there, but of course, because it's Wesley Snipes chewing the scenery, he can't help but pretend to trip over and be inconvenienced by his intestines the whole way out towards the door, where he makes his rambling speech about his goodbye, and then leaves, and then comes back in and says, oh, I won't see you at the premiere, because I don't think this sort of thing's going to have a premiere. Yeah. And then he leaves again, and Eddie Murphy's got to like cheer everybody up, and he gives them the...
I am glad that on his way out that they didn't do the easy joke of letting the intestines get caught in the door.
don't let the door hit you where the GI split you.
Gross.
But they had the DP guy. He's like, yeah, we need to say rap, otherwise it's not the end of the picture. And so Eddie Murphy says, all right, rap. And then they're like, no, say it like Dolomite does. And then yay. And that's a big thing. Mm-hmm. Again, I would say that's probably one of the weaker written moments of circling the wagons in support of our main character. But yeah, it works.
Even if somebody like Rosemary's Baby, elevator operator, crapped on your parade, you're in a room full of people who literally just made a movie just by force of sheer will. Like, you made a movie. Like, that's something to celebrate under all circumstances, even if it's terrible.
Yeah. And the next problem for him is that he wants to get his film exhibited and distributed by a studio. And all the studios he's approached have denied him. And we know that because he has a clipboard where he has helpfully crossed out every studio one by one.
It is a very one-sided phone conversation where you can tell it's not going very well.
No, I didn't think that was a particular, I mean, it conveyed what was happening in the scene, but
yeah,
like
it lacked a bit of subtlety.
No, it was a little silly. And then he has the scene in the diner where he blows up his friends because like he can't just keep paying for everybody anymore. Like, they need to pay for themselves because he's just gonna spend the rest of his life in debt, and nobody's going to see his movie. And he goes back on tour, and he's in Indianapolis, and Chris Rock is the DJ, and he's making a promotional appearance on the radio show
He even literally says like he's at his lowest low because he's lower than he was before because he doesn't even own any of the rights to the record stuff that he's selling at the card table in the back of the club for, you know, a few bucks here and there.
Yeah, and he's still got to keep doing it. And so when he's in Indianapolis and Chris Rock confronts him, is like, so what about that movie? When's the date? And he's like, I don't know. There's no date. And he's like, can you give us a hint? And he's like, there's no hint. I wish I could give you. I would give you something if I could. They go to a commercial break. Chris Rock shuts the door and he says, what's up? And this is a short version of the story where he's like, yeah, nobody's going to distribute my movie. And Chris Rock's character turns over to him a piece of paper with the name of a cousin of his who runs the Uptown theater. And
this is where we explain to the audience what four-walling is, which is what Netflix does with their movies when they want them to be eligible for awards, or at least you can. You go rent out a theater. You can get your movie shown in a theater. You just give them money and say, show my movie in this theater, and I'll promote it, and I'll get people here, and you don't have to do anything. Just like if people show up, give me the ticket money, and we'll be good to go. And then, of course, being that he is the loud, egocentric character of Dolemite, he sets about promoting it as hard as he possibly can. And this is another Blues Brothers moment where he's like driving around with a megaphone out the window of his car saying like, please show up to my midnight showing of the movie. And he fills it up and people come to see it and they laugh and they love it. And even to the point where the guy running the theater pops in partway through and he goes like, is this supposed to be a comedy? I don't get it. Like, what's the deal? He's like, the audience loves it. They get it. It doesn't matter if you don't get it or not. Like, I connected with the people. I made a thing that they enjoy. Doesn't matter if everybody gets it. These people love it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of meta commentary here outside of the film. Then because of this, some guy with a Variety, they see the charts that it was a 98% whatever thing on there.
Was that like a Rotten Tomatoes thing? Like, what the hell was that chart supposed to actually be? I didn't quite tell.
I think it was supposed to be ticket sales, percentage of seats sold. But
oh, okay. Because he calls him up and he says, like, is this the man who broke the record with his movie at a midnight showing or whatever? And it's like, what record did he break? Like, maybe just he packed this giant theater.
I'm just really surprised that they had that reported in that manner. So I don't know if that's technically accurate for how they would report these numbers back then, but it's obvious that somehow it was reported that this movie theater had been sold out, and Dimension Films got in touch with him. They had previously rejected him.
Dimension Films headed by Bob Odenkirk.
And Bob Odenkirk is eager to get the rights to the film so that he can sell it himself. So there's a meeting that happens, where we have our intrepid gang, all suited up,
as their characters.
Yeah, basically. Cause Queen Bee is even wearing yellow with like a little black, like fascinator thing. It was interesting. But they go in and they sit there and they go through the whole thing, the whole spiel. And they're not supposed to talk, but then they talk, and then they're not supposed to do this, and then they do that, and then Eddie Murphy tries to fake him out with this, but then he doesn't, and they agree. Yeah. So
this is the first time where he's finally, like, he's saying, what do I need you for? Everything I've ever done in my entire life that has succeeded has been me doing it myself. And they're like, sure, fine, yeah, you can do that. You can go show your movie to one theater of people at a time for the rest of your life until you die. Or you can use a movie distributor, which is what we are, because we want to work with you, and we're sorry about the thing. And, you know, he basically says, like, all right, I've accrued enough confidence in myself to sort of buy into this system now and say, don't screw with me, because, you know, if you do, I'll punch you in the face and then just go do it myself anyway. what doesn't Bob Odenkirk say, like, don't rip my intestines out
or
something?
Which is interesting, because it's like I didn't realize he had screened the film. But maybe he just read the movie review from the Indianapolis.
He read the coverage from whichever underling went and saw it and then wrote it up for him. Yeah.
But
I don't think Eddie Murphy has more than one copy of this film rolling around.
I don't know. But they make this agreement, and then they start showing it in theaters. Eddie Murphy's recording like little snippets that they're supposed to play on the radio to promote it, for every theater. And, they're finally going to go to the Orpheum, in LA.
Super excited the whole time. Like, he's like, this is our thing. This is our premiere. We got it. The world's going to see it. It's amazing.
Yeah, and the Orpheum had previously been used as a set piece for the front page. So now, you know, this is a way for the movie to say, hey, he made it. He made it big. And so they roll up in a red limousine, and there's a conversation, you know, like, I don't see anybody like myself in the pictures. Thank you for doing that. It's a little on the nose, but they, you know, it is a true sentiment to the film. And there's also a conversation where they're reading through the reviews and they're like, oh, everybody says it's crap. And he's like, well, so what? And he reads a review and he's like, this one says it's vulgar and crass and all this other stuff. And it's like, that's great. Everybody's going to show up because they want to see that. And it turns out, of course, he's right, because they pull up in the limo and predictably, oh, no, we stopped suddenly. What could it possibly be? It's a crowd of people outside the movie theater. No way. Just like the three other times in the movie that happened.
It's a massive crowd. They were saying, you know, they were getting down about the reviews. He said, you know what? It's a success. Even if five people show up, we made a movie. We're on our way to our premiere. Like, we're going to be happy. We're going to choose to be happy and celebrate. And of course, you know, this being a movie itself, there has to be a little bit of a happy ending. So yes, of course, they were prepared for the worst, but it turns out it was the biggest success. 10 p.m. sold out, midnight sold out. They're probably going to have to do a 2 a.m. showing just to satisfy everyone so they don't riot and burn the theater down or whatever. And everyone's thrilled. Everyone's there like wanting autographs and seeing him. And there's even kids who are saying like, you're my idol. I want to be just like you when I grow up. And I want to like touch your hand and stuff as you walk by. And, you know, there's a fairly touching moment where they're all going into the theater and he's like, you know what? You all go in there, enjoy the movie. I'm going to stay out here with the fans because they're going to be out here for the next, you know, 4 or 6 hours or whatever, waiting for their screening of the movie to start. So I'm going to stay out here and give them some Dolomite because that's what they're here for. And he talks to the kid and he has a little back and forth banter and they riff on, you know, rhymes and jokes and stuff. And he gives the kid his cane and the kid's, you know, amazed and super happy. And he's doing crowd work and he's hopping up on a light pole and he's calling people names. I don't want to bleep it, so I'm not going to say it. But it's a very feel good ending, and of course it ends with, you know, some title cards talking about how it's one of the biggest movies of the year, made $10 million, and they made what, five more of them or something?
Oh, I think it was more than that, wasn't it? Like 6 or 7. But
who knows?
They made several, many sequels to the Dolomite stuff. Rudy Ray Moore unfortunately died in 2008, so he's not seeing this picture, but he was someone that the writers and Eddie Murphy consulted with while they were trying to get it made in the earlier part of the 21st century.
Sounds like they got to interview him a handful of times for some stories for the movie. I also saw in there, I was on Wikipedia, that the DP kid showed up to the actual set of Eddie Murphy's movies and offered like some additional stories and context while they were shooting, which is insane.
Yeah. You know, people have stories.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all in all, happy ending.
Happy an ending as this movie could possibly have, probably.
Yeah, and I think it is
Oh my God. There was a Dolomite movie in 2002?
Wow.
He was making these for a long time.
Quite a while.
Wow. Sorry, I just finally clicked on Rudy's IMDb page.
Yeah, he's a pretty prolific guy. But honestly, to be 100% honest, I'm not sure I recall hearing of him.
No, I don't think I had specifically heard his name before either. Like, I feel like there's enough context around him, you know, especially because he's got credit from hip-hop musicians as being an early rapper with his comedy and the rhyming and stuff. I feel like I'm familiar with him as sort of like a reference, but definitely the name did not stick.
But I think this movie is pretty well cast. I think it's well directed. The writing has some bumps, like I said, in terms of just sort of the predictability of how, like, oh no, what are we gonna do? I know what I'm gonna do. I can't do anything. I did it. yay, everybody showed up to love me. And that happens.
Nobody wants to help me. I'm going to succeed on my own. Well, look, I succeeded on my own. How great is that?
I mean, but, you know, it is based on, like, in a biographical sense, like, he did exert, it's just that dramatically in the course of the film as depicted by the film, it just didn't always read super organic. But the, you know, I like Divine Joy Randolph. She was really good. And I liked Mike Epps. And I liked, you know, Titus, as we talked about, wasn't really in here very much. And Wesley,
good Craig Robinson. You got some Wesley Snipes, yeah.
Wesley Snipes is just, I don't know. give him a whole movie to keep doing whatever it was he was doing, because that was fascinating for me.
He tried a lot of things in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, man, I wonder what Coming to America 2 is going to be like.
Yeah, he's in that, huh? General Easy. He should do another Blade, but as the character from this movie.
Oh, yeah, you should. Oh, man.
He should do Blade Is My Name, where it's like the story of the making of Blade.
Mm-hmm.
But it's him as that character.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anywho, Wesley Snipes. Briefly at this, but huge impression afterwards.
Yes. I had no idea really what to expect out of this movie, other than that I was familiar with that it was a guy making a bad 70s movie, action. You call it an action movie? I don't know what you call this kind of movie.
He said it's three things. It's got your action, it's got your comedy, you know, it's got your
kung fu,
which is, I would honestly say, is probably under the action category, but I guess back then it was a distinct genre. It's got it, you know, it's all going on. I would say this is pretty much a crowd pleaser. I don't have any like objection to the film, but I don't know. I think I had expected it to be more out and out funny, I guess, in a general sense. It was a little more down to earth than I had expected.
It's got to be grounded. There was a lot of grounding the character in sort of existential despair.
But then I also have like this conflicted feeling of like, I feel like, especially at the beginning of the movie, Eddie is like kind of playing sort of a version of a Saturday Night Live character of himself-ish, sort of, instead of necessarily like disappearing into the role. Maybe. I don't know. But
I mean, it's probably difficult for him to disappear into anything anymore in general, just because he's done so many things.
Yeah.
I'm a little worried for the Beverly Hills Cop stuff, because, like, to see him attempt to get back into Axel Foley is going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
Because he's not Axel Foley. Like, that's a bit different than his regular out-of-the-box personality, I think.
Yeah. Also, I'm going to reveal a little secret. I never saw Beverly Hills Cop 3, so I should probably do that before I see Beverly Hills Cop 4.
I'm not sure that's necessary.
Maybe I'll make you watch it with me.
all right, that's the one with Uncle Dave.
Uncle Dave.
Uncle Dave is a Walt Disney type character.
Oh, because it's a theme park thing, right?
Yeah, it's a rebranded Disneyland thing.
Oh.
And it's got that one guy from Pretty Woman in it, the guy who plays the stuck-up hotel guy. I can never remember that guy's name.
It's okay. I'm not really doing great on names tonight. It's decent. I like this. They should have promoted it more than they did, Netflix.
Meaning none?
0%. I feel like Eddie Murphy appearing on Saturday Night Live for the first time in like 30 years and enlisting the help of all of his friends in the opening monologue and people who were inspired by him in order to do that, I feel like that was more marketing than Netflix did for this movie at all, period. Which I think is saying a lot. If I were Eddie Murphy, I might be a little disappointed in the amount of marketing budget that Netflix pointed at this as compared to something like The Irishman. Not that I'm saying this movie is The Irishman. I'm just saying, like, Netflix is just very selective about what it chooses to market and then what it chooses to just dump onto its service unceremoniously to wither on the vine.
Yeah, I do think there is something to the fact that Eddie Murphy is just kind of an enigma. Like, he's a confusing man in his own right. Like, it's hard for him to be anything other than Eddie Murphy these days. Whereas Scorsese, like, Scorsese is built to be marketed to people because of what he does.
Well, he's a brand. Scorsese has a brand. But I see you sent me a photo.
Oh, yeah, that's from Beverly Hills Cop 3.
George Lucas is in Beverly Hills Cop 3?
Evidently.
Okay.
I didn't realize that, but I was clicking through some photos. There he is.
Huh. Well, he made a lot of bad choices at that juncture.
Yeah, I think that's like a single shot cameo for him.
Oh man, if only he had sold his Star Wars to whatever evil empire was inside that movie. But anyway, I think that concludes our little chit chat. On Dolomite, and it was his name. One last thing. I like that this movie went after the front page. I don't like the Walter Matthau Jack Lemmon one. I don't think it's very good. His Girl Friday is way better.
Stance here.
Yeah. Suck it, Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder even said it wasn't that good of a movie. Yeah, there you go.
I hadn't seen it. Not familiar with it, so... I mean, I'm familiar with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau.
Yeah, well, we'll do a front page retrospective where we watch the original 1931 version, then we watch the version with Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant, His Girl Friday, and then we'll watch the Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon version, where you will wish for death.
But I tell you what, if this podcast ever moved from The Incomparable to NPR, I will do that.
I don't think we have those kinds of standards here. But on that threatening note, let's conclude for the evening.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Is our name.
It's not my... Hello, goodbye. My name's Joe.